So welcome to the second episode of Joint Ventures, the podcast where we try to make sense of the biggest advances in autoimmune disease. In the previous episode, we looked into our relationship with rheumatology, but today's show is diving into the science. It's all about mechanisms. Today, it's going to be Fc gamma receptors and TYK2 inhibition, two pathways that are very different, but share something very important in that they offer us new tools for patients who haven't had many in the past.
And it's not theoretical anymore. It's the right time to speak about both of these treatments because deucravacitinib has is awaiting FDA application outcome of that at the beginning of March, so the upcoming weeks, for treatment for psoriatic arthritis. And there is very promising phase 2 data about nipocalimab in lupus and more in Sjögren's disease, what have come out in the past year. So we will hear about these both drugs and both medicines a lot more in upcoming year or so. So it's good time to examine what they are and the importance of them.
Let's start with nipocalimab. So Fc gamma receptor inhibition sounds niche, but the logic is very elegant. The Fc gamma receptor protects IgG from degradation. So if you block it, pathogenic IgGs like double-stranded DNA are cleared much faster.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I didn't know about this IgG recycling pathway before hearing about nipocalimab. I wouldn't be surprised if you knew about it, Jack, to be honest. So what happens normally is, so the IgG has this recycling pathway when it's taken from the bloodstream into the endothelial cells, where it binds with FcR receptor, and this binding prevents from the IgG molecule to go lysosomal degradation. And this results that the molecule gets transported back to the cell surface and released into the bloodstream. So that makes sense why IgG half-life is much more longer compared to the other immunoglobulins. But the idea is by blocking this receptor, by blocking this binding, you trap the IgG molecule in a cell where it's going to be degraded. I think if I automatically thought about therapeutic plasma exchange, kind of, that there is similarity, isn't it? If in plasma exchange you mechanically remove the immunoglobulins alongside with the autoantibodies from the bloodstream, with nipocalimab we are trying to trap the IgG in the cells, but the result is the same. You take it out from the bloodstream and kind of trying to stop that pathological process what is driven by those autoantibodies. And although we in rheumatology, we're just starting to talk about it because first data coming out, it's already established in other autoimmune diseases as myasthenia gravis. It's FDA, EMA approved to for treatment of generalized myasthenia.
And it's now had a win, or an early win, in lupus with the Jasmine trial, which is sort of what's brought us to it. And you know. Yeah. They've released a press release, Johnson & Johnson, with positive top-line results relatively recently in January. So I'll just sort of summarise those. You had 228 lupus patients in the randomised placebo-controlled trial, phase 2b study. Primary endpoint here was SRI-4, which is a very durable outcome measure in lupus, at week 24. And the study was positive, hitting with statistical significance against placebo. So really exciting initial data. We have to be careful about how much stock we put in this, but certainly very interesting initial results.
Because so far we only have press release, isn't it? Yeah. And we are going to see more data in upcoming conferences throughout this year, but I think it definitely sounds promising. As I think, as you probably know better than me, we can't get overexcited with a positive phase 2 trials in lupus, as there is a tendency when they go to phase 3, fail miserably. But I think obviously we last year it was published this Sjogren's data, and I think Sjogren's World is very excited about that. And I'm not sure if you saw that the FDA last week granted breakthrough therapy designation. So there was definitely quite invested interest to try and speed up the phase 3 trial and see the results of that for Sjogren's, because as we know, there's no licensed treatments not licensed biological treatments for Sjogren's. What about safety? What do we know about safety so far?
So they saw some good signs, some good early signs. So good early signs of steroid tapering, some improvements in key secondary and some exploratory endpoints as well. No major safety issues at this point in time, consistent with previous studies. So pretty good so far. And as you say, they're driving on to a phase 3 in lupus. But as you mentioned as well, you know, the phase 2 Dahlia study in Sjogren's, again, met its primary endpoint with nipocalimab, good reductions in clinical SDI scores at week 24, good improvement in symptoms that are quite hard to address, like fatigue in Sjogren's, which is always difficult to assess. And the phase 3 for that is pending as well. And then more broadly, obviously, we've seen phase 2 data in rheumatoid arthritis with some clinical responses, although somewhat more modest than what we're seeing in connective tissue disease. So maybe a role in combination with other treatments as opposed to monotherapy.
Yeah, and from the Sjogren's trial data, what we were able to see that safety data from infection perspective looks very good. And initially I thought, oh, you are lowering the IgG levels in the blood that will result in more infections. But actually, if you think about more of it, it actually is not the case, because you are targeting the immune system for fairly downstream, isn't it? So your cellular immunity remains intact and unaffected, same as your vaccine response should not be altered with this as well. But you mentioned trials in rheumatoid arthritis, and what was very interesting thing was I saw in those. So obviously we can easily measure autoantibody levels, and at least at the molecular level, we'll be able to tell if the drug is working or not. If dsDNA antibody levels after treatment goes down, you know it's working. If rheumatoid factor CCP antibodies go down, then it's working as well, isn't it? But interesting thing about rheumatoid factor, what I saw was that it obviously lowered rheumatoid factor levels, but as we know, the rheumatoid factor is not only IgG molecule, it can be all the immunoglobulins, including IgM. And when they did more analysis looking what actually, which types of immunoglobulins from factor goes down, predominant reduction in rheumatoid factor levels was because of IgM rather than IgG. And IgM doesn't go this recycling pathway of what IgG does. So it kind of makes you think, is there something more, whether there is kind of interaction just beyond, and is there any effect on other immunoglobulin molecules? I think we yet to really see that, isn't it? But I thought that was quite an interesting fact.
And it's interesting to sort of see where, I mean, we're obviously, this is early data. There's a lot of water to go under the bridge. There's a lot of, you know, a lot more to tease out with this, but where it's going to sit potentially in lupus and Sjogren's, you know, I suppose looking at lupus, you know, this is a novel mechanism in this disease. Where is it going to sit? Is it going to sit in, you know, cases where anifrolumab or belimumab haven't delivered? It's got reasonably good steroid tapering data, or, you know, the early signs are that it's good. So is it going to be something we use to try and get these patients who are stuck on long-term steroids down? So it's interesting, isn't it? It's a sort of broadly effective treatment potentially across multiple diseases, and it'll be interesting to see where it's going to fit in to the therapeutic landscape. It's a good time to be in lupus and connective tissue disease, because we are just
So we have to look out for the data. what was be presented this year. Let's wait for phase three trial data, what probably for Sjögren's will come out first. But then let's not forget there is ongoing phase two in rheumatoid arthritis. But in rheumatoid arthritis, interestingly, they compare combination satralizumab with nipocalimab versus satralizumab alone. That's interesting. And there's ongoing trials in inflammatory myopathy as well. So we can definitely will get more data and see across different diseases what effect it has.
I think cautious optimism. We have to be careful because the road to ruin is paved with biological plausibility. And as you say, in lupus, we have a somewhat checkered history with clinical trials, although we are starting to break that duck. So I'm hoping that I'm very hopeful.
That's what we okay. Okay, so we can move to the deucravacitinib now. What again is complete, although I say complete new mechanism, it's not really new, but it's related to already existing treatments. But we are for first time we are targeting TYK2, what is tyrosine kinase 2 inhibitor. And I think it's important to a bit pause and think about mechanism of action that and what its relation is particularly to JAK inhibitors because what will be the key while we'll be talking about it. As we know, the main cytokines what drives especially psoriasis but not isolated other autoimmune conditions is IL-23 and IL-12. And then those activate Th17 cells, what then produces pro-inflammatory cytokines, what then triggers inflammatory cascade. And there has been much more interest actually to understand what happens in Th17 cell, what results for them to produce these pro-inflammatory cytokines, and how we can intervene there to stop that gene expression from happening. And that's where kinases came in. So we know JAK1, JAK2, and JAK3, and the JAK inhibitors what targets them. And actually, TYK2is one of the Janus kinases. So it's in the same family alongside with JAK1, JAK2, and JAK3. It has a different name and as more almost like a child from a different marriage. But it pretty much does is the same, but there is some key differences. And the main one is that the cytokines, what the signal through TYK2, has much more narrow spectrum compared to other JAKs. And it's predominantly, well, we mentioned IL-23 and IL-12. So by targeting TYK2, we feel we are affecting more selective immune pathways, not this much more broader one, what we achieve with them with the JAK inhibitors. And secondly, it's a feeling that we are not affecting extra immune pathways as bone marrow regulation, lipid metabolism, what other JAKs are involved with. So it sounds like the TYK2 is promising to be the JAK inhibitor what we want it to be before all of the safety data came with that and all the concerns and the baggage what at the moment JAK inhibitors come with.
And as you mentioned, it's new to us in inflammatory arthritis and in rheumatology, but in psoriasis and psoriatic skin disease, it's been around a while now, isn't it? It's an FDA approved since 2022. If you live in the UK, NICE approved since 2023. We always lag a little bit behind. But those early trials, the sort of POETYK trials, show really good PASI 75 responses and ACR 20 responses in psoriatic arthritis. So pretty good. And then looking at the sort of phase three data presented at ACR and EULAR last year with the full results published, they're pretty promising too. So pretty efficacious in psoriatic arthritis with ACR 20s of 54% at week 16 versus 39 in placebo. And importantly, sustained to 62% at week 52. But they're also, the data is, so that's very interesting. We're also seeing good inhibition of radiographic progression as well, which is again sustained through to week 52. So the good data, not surprising, I suppose, in the context of it already being licensed for some time in psoriatic skin disease, but certainly a welcome finding, really.
Yeah, I think it's fairly common that in psoriatic arthritis, we always borrow the treatments what works well for skin psoriasis. So like I mentioned, we are expecting FDA outcome very soon in upcoming weeks, and if it gets approved, then it will be the first TYK2 inhibitor approved and available for rheumatologists to use. But there has been trials in lupus as well, isn't it?
Yes. So that's the Paisley study. So that came in SRI 4 at 58% versus 34% of placebo. Good improvements in BICLA, CLASI and biomarkers. And they then presented the long-term extension data, I think, in late last year, which showed sustained efficacy and consistent safety data out to 4 years of treatment for moderate to severe lupus. So very exciting. They've got phase three trials that are ongoing, and those are probably going to finish, I think, in around 2028. But again, this is another one of those drugs that's going to span potentially several of our existing diagnoses and is looking good in early stage data. Certainly TYK2 inhibition is looking promising in lupus and is attracting quite a bit of interest, I think.
Yeah. And obviously safety will be a key thing, isn't it? That will be the thing what will differentiate TYK2 inhibition from JAK inhibitors. And so we have, like you mentioned, we have data up to week 52 from PSA trials, but we have up to 4 year data from skin psoriasis. And there is some minor upper airway infections. Some people, there was some signal in developing acne, but actually serious infection rate was very, very low. Definitely there was no signal having increased opportunistic infections and no really safety signal relating to MACE and VTE. So it might be the JAK inhibitor what we wanted from beginning, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think it's a very promising oral agent. It has that niche as well that some patients prefer oral treatments. And what we know from PSA data is that it works, is effective to different domains of psoriasis. We know it works quite very good for skin. There's very good data for joints, but in secondary outcomes, they looked at enthesitis, dactylitis, and it appeared to be effective as well. So I think that it will have a role for our patients who with this multi-domain involvement of their disease. Obviously, we will yet to have to see whether it has any effect on axial disease, IBD and inflammatory eye diseases. But I think it is going to be very promising. We will need to see much more long-term data and, more importantly, head-to-head studies to see where it fits, where it's going to fit in already existing psoriatic arthritis treatments. What I know it's quite early days, but where do you think it would fit in SLE treatment pathways?
Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, as you say, it's an oral agent, so that's already a big thumbs up for many people. It's, you know, showing less safety signals or no real safety signals related to MACE and VTE. So that is addressing one of the key concerns for a lot of people. I suppose it may work in early lupus or certainly in skin predominant cases or those who are, again, stuck on steroids for long periods of time. And of course, we do occasionally see, you know, overlap patients, you know, between the two conditions. They're not enormously common, but I think most people have seen one or two within their training. And then I suppose just to say outside of lupus as well, you know, that this is very much into the early stage data, but we are seeing some evidence of efficacy in Sjögren's disease and certainly some modulation of fibrosis and inflammation in systemic sclerosis as well. So again, another broad mechanism, and great if it's able to address, you know, these overlap patients, which, as we say, aren't very common, but they do cause problems sometimes because you don't naturally reach for an anti-TNF in these patients, which is often the backbone of treatment. So, yeah.
I was thinking about these oral patients as well. And although I have to be honest, I have not come across maybe a few of them, but I was trying to find how actually common is and what registry data there is. And there is data from Sweden and other places. And I was actually quite surprised to see that the prevalence for coexisting psoriasis in patients with lupus was around 5%. That's what was quite high, and that definitely wouldn't really fit with my clinical experience. But I think it just shows that those patients exist, and I appreciate sometimes it might be difficult with the cutaneous lupus and psoriasis to distinguish them, and there might be diagnostic uncertainty, but. It definitely would be a very attractive agent to use in those cases.
Yeah, it's a sort of neat crossover at that sort of intersection of the two conditions. So I suppose if you have something that has trial data in both, you're naturally going to reach for that. So it's interesting, isn't it? So two interesting mechanisms. We've got obviously nipocalimab with the Fc gamma receptor, and we've sort of assess, you know, we've sort of gone over the IgG clearance logic and how that's going to affect its cause, how that's going to be effective across, you know, multiple different diseases. And then TYK2 as well, again, bridging multiple conditions, both in CTD and within psoriatic disease as well. So very interesting.
And that is an interesting development, isn't it? That we're trying to find the treatments which works not for isolated condition, but we can use across the different ones. Although trying to target much more narrow immune system pathways, not having this very broad immunomodulation, but while maintaining it quite narrow, for them to be effective across different conditions in rheumatology.
Yeah. And that's not totally new. Obviously, Johnson & Johnson tried that with ustekinumab in lupus some time ago. But I think, you know, at that point in time, some of the failure wouldn't be necessarily biologic related. You know, we have had issues with endpoints and other issues associated with that. So it's not a completely new idea. But it's interesting to see it sort of bearing fruit, I suppose, at this point in time. Which is, you know, it's a good time to be in the field it's an interesting development, really.
And to be realistic, neither of them will be a silver bullet, isn't it? So, but I think there will be useful tools in additional tool in our arsenal to use for treatment options. And we're going to hear more and more about two pathways and targeting these two pathways and about two drugs. So I think it will be exciting to see more data. And then when eventually they do get approved, they come into real life where we can see some real world evidence and see how they work outside the trial settings. And again, it will be important to see head-to-head studies to see how do they compare with already existing treatments. And that will be important when we see patients' treatment choice, what we will be able to make for them.
Yeah. But I'm optimistic. Early signs are good, aren't they? And it's looking like it's a promising development on both sides. So I think that's all we've got time for. Thanks for listening to Joint Ventures. And next month, we'll be looking at something a little bit more clinical, straying away from mechanisms into individual diseases and day-to-day management. So look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. And we'll see you next time.
See you.